Lecture 19, Cold War Chill.
Mayday, mayday, mayday. That is the international distress signal on radio from the French, Venez m'aider, come help me. Mayday, on the other hand, that is May 1st, the first day of the month of May, was also a special holiday in the Soviet Union and in other communist countries. It was International Workers' Day, with parades in Moscow's Red Square, red flags, and displays of party power. So it was doubly appropriate, or ironic, that it was on May Day, May 1st, 1960, that an American spy plane was in distress, hurtling down from the skies over the Soviet Union, as it had been hit by anti-aircraft missiles in the middle of the Cold War. The pilot of the U-2 plane was Gary Powers, flying for the CIA, with a cover story of working for the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, which later became NASA. Powers had been born in Kentucky. He was a graduate of Milligan College in Tennessee and had served in the U.S. Air Force as a fighter pilot. In 1956, he'd been recruited into the CIA's spy plane program, checking up from a great height on Soviet missile installations. Earlier that day, Powers had taken off from Peshawar, Pakistan, preparing to fly nearly 4,000 miles, most of them over the Soviet Union. Flying at over 70,000 feet, he thought he was safe. But then, over Sverdlovsk, his plane was hit. Powers pressed the button to eject and exploded out of the cockpit. His parachute opened, and he drifted down to the ground where Soviet police arrived to arrest him. What followed then was a long, agonizing series of cringe-inducing embarrassments in the public relations theater of the Cold War. At first, the CIA gave the American press a false story that a weather research plane over Turkey had been lost. Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev responded explosively, denouncing Americans both for spying and for lying. Khrushchev revealed that Powers was alive and in custody. Ordinary Americans saw the spectacle of their government's lying exposed. Powers was put on trial in a media mega event. He was convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison. By 1962, he was released in exchange for a Soviet spy who had been caught in the United States. Later, the development of spy satellites meant that the need for such risk-filled spy flights was reduced. With Stalin's death in 1953, the Cold War did not come to a close. The political dynamics were larger than any one individual. The Cold War chill instead deepened, and espionage and covert actions took on a new intensity, accelerated by technological advances in signals intelligence, or SIGINT, spy planes like the U-2, and the building of covert installations, which we'll explore in this lecture. When Stalin died, his own secret police chief and fellow Georgian, Lavrenty Beria, stepped into a leadership role, along with other Soviet leaders who'd been close to Stalin, including Khrushchev. Beria was a keenly feared figure. His rivals, led by Khrushchev, plotted to remove him and ambushed him at a leadership meeting in June 1953. The astonished Beria was put on trial, improbably accused of treason and espionage. It was claimed that Beria had ties to foreign intelligence agencies and that Beria had earlier conspired to aid Nazi Germany and the Western capitalist powers. The methods of Stalin's own show trials were now being turned on his henchman, who was convicted and executed in December of 1953. For the next few years, a series of purges eliminated the last of Beria's allies among the secret police. And now the Soviet secret police was once again reorganized in March 1954, and it was renamed the KGB. That stood for Komitet Государственной Безопасности, the Committee for State Security. Of all of those many shifting names of the Soviet security origins that we've mentioned in these lectures over the years, this was the one that stuck longest until 1991. The KGB was effective in clamping down on internal dissent and in closing off the country to Western intelligence. In fact, it was going to be the notorious difficulty of getting human or human intelligence access into the Soviet Union that motivated such Western espionage overflights of the U-2 and other SIGINT efforts at surveillance. Or, for instance, the setting up of radio intercept stations in Turkey and West Germany, which were constantly listening to radio traffic in the East Bloc. A new key institution in this task was the American National Security Agency, or NSA, established in 1952 by Truman. It's the main American SIGINT agency, intercepting communications worldwide across a range of technologies, and it's highly secret. Indeed, some joke that the bureaucratic acronym NSA stands for No Such Agency, or Never Say Anything. A changing of the guard was also taking place in the CIA. When President Eisenhower came to office in January of 1953, he chose a new director of Central Intelligence, for the first time a civilian, Alan Dulles, who remained in that post until 1961. Dulles came of a family already notable for its public service. In fact, while Alan Dulles was CIA director, his brother, John Foster Dulles, was the Secretary of State. Some cabinet meetings must have seemed like family reunions. Alan Dulles, during the Second World War, was in the OSS. He ran the OSS branch in Bern, Switzerland, and had recruited some important spies within Nazi Germany. Now, as Dulles took over the CIA, it was the start of what might be called the Dulles era, from 1953 to 1961. The CIA had grown in size. By 1953, it was six times larger than when it was first founded in 1947. Increasingly, the CIA's original role of intelligence gathering and coordination was being crowded out by covert operations and political interventions abroad. In these days of Cold War crisis, the CIA operated with remarkable autonomy, with little in the way of congressional oversight. It intervened abroad, as when in 1953, the CIA toppled the Prime Minister Mossadegh in Iran, and we'll discuss this case in our next lecture on world crises. Also in 1954, the CIA helped topple the Arbenz government in Guatemala. In both cases, and in many others, the CIA argued that intervention was justified to foil communist subversion. There were also interventions that did not happen. The most important case of this came during the Hungarian uprising of 1956. Hungarian communist leaders had set out on a reformist path and attempted to steer a course more independent from Moscow, but then Soviet tanks rolled in. Hungarian rebels had been encouraged by Western radio broadcasts they'd heard on Radio Free Europe, which led them to believe that America and its allies would come to their rescue. This did not happen. Some 20,000 Hungarians were killed, and around 200,000 of them fled the country, nearly 2% of the entire population of Hungary. An unheralded secret project of this period involved the Berlin Tunnel. Berlin was, in a sense, always the ground zero of the Cold War. It was a vivid and sensitive spot where the division of Germany, and indeed the world, along Cold War lines was made obvious. Defeated Germany had been divided into zones of occupation, with Americans, British, and French in the west, and the Soviet zone in the east. Berlin itself lay 100 miles in the eastern zone, but the city was itself, in a microcosm of Germany's division, placed under four-power administration as well, itself divided into zones. Berlin could be a hotspot of Cold War confrontation. Because it was an open city and no Berlin Wall had been built as yet, refugees from Eastern Europe or Eastern Germany could sluice through in the thousands in a human draining of population away from the communist world. Berlin would also be a consummate espionage battleground, and not just above ground. In 1953, Britain's MI6 and the CIA, in an act of international cooperation, conceived the plan of building a tunnel from the western zone of Berlin under the east. This is what they named Operation Gold. The tunnel was dug 400 yards under the Soviet side to tap telephone cables between Soviet High Command in Berlin to General Staff and Foreign Office in Moscow and all Soviet installations in East Germany. The tunnel was dug some 15 feet underground, and inside it was 6 feet high. Its secret construction was a marvel of engineering and cunning. The tunnel had to be strong enough to withstand Soviet tanks rolling overhead. At the spot where the tunnel was built, on the American side, a warehouse was constructed. But all that that warehouse eventually contained was the earth removed in the digging. Metal machinery or braces were sprayed with a rubberizing chemical so they wouldn't clang and bang loudly underground while under the Soviet side. A great problem also appeared. The tunnel, which contained electronic communications equipment for tapping, was also, as a result, quite warm because these generated heat. In times of winter snow, the tunnel would likely show up above ground as a bare patch that quite obviously would run from the American side to the Soviet compound. Working fast to deal with this emergency, the builders actually installed an air conditioning system in record speed to keep the tunnel cool. I think this is an ultimate symbol of Cold War espionage, an air-conditioned secret tunnel. Once the tunnel was completed, MI6 and the CIA could listen to over 430 Soviet telephone lines, the conversations recorded by tape. But there's another mystery here, a mystery behind the mystery. The KGB actually knew about the tunnel even as it was being built, because a British double agent had betrayed its existence. But the KGB didn't shut down the project at once. It's not entirely clear why. It may be that they saw it as a chance to cunningly feed disinformation to the West. Or it may be that it would have been too difficult to shut down the tunnel without revealing the existence of their British mole. Operation Gold only finally ended when the tunnel was, quote-unquote, discovered in April 1956. Several years later, in August 1961, another secret construction project in Berlin took the West by surprise, as East German police finally built a wall across the city. It was called the Anti-Fascist Protective Barrier, allegedly to keep spies from the West out, but in fact to keep people in. Behind this wall, the East German Stasi secret police set up a remarkably intense surveillance, which we'll discuss in detail in Lecture 22. Another covert construction project that speaks volumes about the looming and threatening Cold War was much closer to home for Americans. This was a civil defense plan to protect the U.S. Congress in the event of nuclear war. From 1959 to 1962, in an operation codenamed Project Greek Island, an extensive secret bunker was built under the Greenbrier Resort Hotel in White Sulphur Springs in the mountains of West Virginia. It was equipped with 30-ton blast doors, ventilation systems, bunk beds, a cafeteria, and television studios with backdrops of scenes of Washington, D.C., from which representatives could broadcast reassuring messages to a post-apocalypse America. Today, this historical site, which is unlike any other I have ever visited, is open to the public for a fee, and it's an amazing place to tour, and I recommend it most strongly to everyone. The prospect of the Cold War turning hot seemed to come closest in tension over Cuba, located 90 miles from the United States. In January 1959, Fidel Castro and his guerrilla forces overthrew the Batista regime in Cuba. As Castro avowed communism and moved closer to the Soviet Union and confiscated U.S. property in Cuba, the American government came to view him as a threat. Under Eisenhower, a plan was developed for an invasion of Cuba, to be done not by American forces, but by several hundred Cuban exiles with American covert support. The hope was that this invasion would spark a nationwide revolt overthrowing Castro. By 1961, the new Kennedy administration inherited the ongoing project, and after changes to the plan and a series of postponements, the invasion was finally launched in April 1961, aiming at the Bay of Pigs in Cuba. What followed was a perfect storm of failure. The exiles landed on the beach and immediately came under heavy counterattack. They pleaded for effective American air cover or intervention by U.S. Marines, but neither happened, as the operation was supposed to allow plausible deniability, however absurd that pretense was to a world audience. Over 1,000 Cuban exiles were captured, and no revolt materialized. The total failure of the Bay of Pigs operation was a huge blow to the new Kennedy administration. In its aftermath, the CIA was finally subjected to closer control, and Alan Dulles was removed as director. But at the same time, the CIA also was plunged into further covert operations at a time of international crises. The CIA's Operation Mongoose, for instance, proposed sabotage and fomenting unrest in Cuba. Other plans called for the assassination of Castro. But none of these projects were helped by a single fact. From 1961, every single agent that the CIA had recruited in Cuba had been turned and manipulated by the Cuban Dirección General de Inteligencia. All the information being fed to the CIA by the 38 Cuban agents it thought it was running was in fact disinformation. And the CIA was actually paying the Cuban intelligence services for these efforts. There's a historical echo here, obviously. We recall that Dzerzhinsky of the Bolshevik CK secret police had pioneered this strategy of setting up a fake counter-revolutionary organization, the Trust. Was this a coincidence, or was this the direct inspiration from the Cuban intelligence, some of whom had been training in the Soviet Union, to look back to this historical precedent? Soon after, Cuba would turn out to be the site of the crisis that, according to many historians, came closest to seeing the Cold War turn hot. If it had, we probably wouldn't be having this lecture today. This was the Cuban Missile Crisis of October and November 1962. Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev had engineered the confrontation by aiming to station nuclear missiles in Cuba to shift the global balance of power. Secretly, Soviet merchant ships brought equipment for missile bases to the island, a fact that the CIA had not detected. Later, U-2 spy plane overflights of Cuba revealed the construction, and the photographs were shown to American allies to build their support for an American naval quarantine of Cuba. Khrushchev and Kennedy exchanged confidential communications, which did calm the crisis, which ended with both sides backing off. Now, as we learned many years later, American intelligence had radically underestimated how close we had come to disaster. The CIA had concluded that no nuclear weapons had been stationed. They had. And the CIA had radically undercounted how many Soviet military staff were already on the island. Kennedy, however, also had received some other secret information from a spy for the Americans high up in the Soviet military, which had helped reduce the extraordinary tensions of the crisis. This spy, Colonel Penkovsky, indicated to the Americans that the Soviets had not ramped up overall military preparations worldwide, which suggested that the crisis could be isolated and negotiated. Let us turn then to some cases of incredible infiltration across the Cold War divide, including those of Colonel Penkovsky and Kim Philby. We've seen earlier in this lecture how much emphasis was now being placed on SIGINT, signals intelligence, and technology in the secret part of the Cold War. And this obviously raises a fundamental question. Did the use of new technology for sophisticated new signals intelligence fundamentally change the nature of spying? Or another way of putting it is, how much did human intelligence still matter? How much could individual spies still do to affect the larger picture? The top agent in the Soviet Union for the Americans was Penkovsky. Remember that we had already mentioned how hard it was for Western intelligence services to penetrate Soviet society. Remember also how badly ventures like Dzerzhinsky's Trust had fooled the opponents of the communists. For this reason, Penkovsky was a walk-in, someone who volunteered his services rather than being somebody who had been carefully targeted by the CIA or the British forces and cultivated over a long time and methodically recruited. He volunteered. In fact, Penkovsky had a hard time convincing at first the Americans and the British that he was a genuine volunteer and not simply somebody who was trying to pull off a provocation for the Soviet side. Let's take a closer look at Colonel Oleg Penkovsky. Penkovsky has been called the most significant Western spy of the Cold War era. Penkovsky was a GRU, or Russian military intelligence officer, who came from an upper-class background. Penkovsky's father had actually served with the counter-revolutionary Russian White Forces in the Civil War, fighting against the Bolsheviks. And thus, Penkovsky afterwards, as an adult, would chafe at the fact that his career had been limited by the sins of his fathers, his family background of privilege and of counter-revolutionary activity. So in 1960, having reached some sort of psychological breaking point, Penkovsky did something dangerous. He simply approached two American tourists, asking them to contact the American embassy for him. Later, both the American CIA and the British MI6 would cooperate in running Penkovsky and being his handlers. And they delighted Penkovsky by symbolic gestures, like taking photographs of him wearing U.S. and British uniforms when he made a visit to London, as sort of a sign that they appreciated his services. Now, in a short period, a remarkably short period, Penkovsky passed more than 10,000 pages of documents and plans to the British and Americans. As we noted a moment ago, Penkovsky's role was crucial. He was most important for reassuring the Americans that the so-called missile gap that was much discussed at the time existed, but not the way people thought. It was actually in the favor of the West rather than that of the Soviets. And of course, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he had indicated that Khrushchev was probably engaged in a maneuver of bluff rather than a preparation for an all-out war against the West. This, obviously, would help to move the crisis away from the brink. In October 1962, however, Penkovsky was arrested by the KGB. And to this very day, it's still not clear, it's still debated how he was betrayed, but many suspect double agents in the British intelligence services as having given him away. He was put on trial in 1963, convicted, and executed. Significantly, the CIA's code name for Penkovsky was Hero. But this important figure in the Cold War, who may have played a decisive, fateful role, is little known today. And there's also another fascinating aspect in the long-term history of espionage to observe here as well. We tend to think of spies as provocative figures who cause crises to flare up or who can provoke wars. But in the case of Penkovsky, he helped to reduce a potentially fatal world crisis and to relax tensions. On the other side of the Cold War divide, there was the climax of the many, many years of Kim Philby's long, spectacular betrayal of British intelligence to the Soviets. The revelations of his duplicity left lasting scars on MI6 and the CIA and did a lot to disturb the so-called special relationship binding the U.S. And Great Britain. Philby had been posted in Washington, D.C. in 1949 as a liaison, a go-between between MI6 and the American services, the CIA and the FBI. This was a tremendously important high-level post. And to some people, it seemed that Philby's career might even be headed for overall command of MI6. Philby was made privy to the highest-level secrets, including the Venona Project. He became a special friend of James Jesus Angleton, who was the head of the CIA's Office of Strategic Operations, and the two frequently lunched and drank a lot together. From the Venona decrypts that he saw, Philby realized that Donald McLean, a friend and fellow member of the Cambridge spy ring, would soon be arrested, and he warned him. Both McLean and Guy Burgess, another of the group, escaped to the Soviet Union in 1951. Philby was suspected because he was a friend of McLean's. He was forced to resign from MI6, but an investigation afterwards exonerated him of the suspicion. Philby now returned to his earlier line of work, journalism. But when suspicion revived against him again in 1963, he too escaped to the Soviet Union. There, Philby was celebrated as a hero of the communist cause. He was even honored with a postage stamp proclaiming him a Soviet spy, a kind of immortality. From Moscow, he was also allowed to publish that strange memoir of his, My Silent War, in 1968. In that memoir, he was quite unrepentant. And the book, moreover, took jabs at his former colleagues in the British Secret Service with a real delight and revealed a very deep cultural antipathy for Americans as people who had supplanted the British leading role in the world. Philby's last years in Moscow, sort of the afterlife of his spying, seem not to have been very happy ones, however, and he died in 1988, just as communist regimes were starting to crumble in Eastern Europe. Philby was buried in Moscow with a rank of KGB general. Philby's betrayal left agonizing questions. How had he gotten away with it? How could a man lead a life that was a lie so consistently? Was he the last of the spies? Were there more? In the CIA, James Jesus Angleton, the counterintelligence expert who had been a friend of Philby's, now set out on a panicked and increasingly irrational search for moles within the highest levels of the CIA itself. Angleton became a haunted figure over this betrayal and was nicknamed the Grey Ghost by his colleagues. He frequently murmured aloud that spying was a wilderness of mirrors. This was a quote taken from a poem by T.S. Eliot, a world in which nothing is quite what it seems, perhaps, in fact, is the opposite, as had been the case with Philby. In 1974, Angleton was forced to retire after more than 20 years of counterintelligence work because superiors feared that his suspicions were just destroying the organization from within. These were years punctuated by acts of violence, great and small. America's conduct of the Vietnam War was intensifying, with American military advisors and the CIA engaged in paramilitary operations in support of the effort. On November 1, 1963, South Vietnam's increasingly unpopular president, Ngo Dinh Diem, was overthrown in a coup by generals and killed. Weeks afterwards, on November 22, 1963, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas by a man who had been a defector to the Soviet Union, Lee Harvey Oswald. In a bizarre series of events, Oswald himself was then killed 2 days later while in custody. These events, which have been the object of intense investigation over and over again, seem so improbable and difficult to assimilate that many Americans believed then and still believe now that there's a different truth behind the official version. I think part of this dynamic is the conviction that huge historical events must have huge historical causes, not only a crazed lone gunman, and thus conspiracy theories have proliferated and continue today. President Richard Nixon, who had made his political name in the House Un-American Activities Committee investigations of the late 1940s, was elected president in 1968 and made personal use of the CIA. On September 11, 1973, Salvador Allende, the socialist president of Chile, was overthrown in a coup by the opposition supported by the CIA. In that coup, he either killed himself or was murdered, and many suspected the CIA. In 1972, the Watergate scandal broke. Some of Nixon's operatives, including ex-CIA staff, had broken into the Democratic Party offices in the Watergate apartment complex with disguises provided by the CIA. After a national nightmare of investigations and denials, Nixon resigned in August 1974. The results that followed were devastating to the CIA and blew the cover off of many other abuses, including domestic spying, planned assassinations of foreign leaders, Castro and Patrice Lumumba, subsidies for cover organizations like the National Student Association and magazines, and a bizarre drug testing program using heroin, amphetamines, and LSD to try to achieve mind control over people, which had caused at least one death when drugs were administered to people without their knowledge. Investigations multiplied, including the Senate's Select Committee to Study Government Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities, which was popularly known by the much more compact name, the Church Committee. More stringent congressional control was imposed, following on the wave of public revulsion at the abuses that had been uncovered. A presidential executive order issued by President Jimmy Carter would prohibit the CIA from involving itself in assassinations. The hearings and investigations left a badly demoralized organization in need of reform and internally racked by the search for moles. In 1976, the new director of the CIA was George Herbert Walker Bush, later the 41st president of the United States. Could the CIA be reconstructed? Should it simply be disbanded? Does a democracy need a secret intelligence organization? Can a democracy survive in a hostile world without one? These were fundamental questions for that time, as well as for ours. I'd like to conclude this lecture with just a brief last story of an assassination, in part because I remember the news myself and how frightening it was, showing the world in its true colors. In 1978, the KGB used a poison umbrella gun to kill a Bulgarian dissident named Georgi Markov in London. On September 7th, 1978, as he waited for a bus, he felt someone stab him in the thigh with a wrapped-up umbrella. The man apologized and disappeared. At first, the wound seemed harmless. Then it grew inflamed. Markov came down with a fever, convulsions, delirium, and then died. A post-mortem investigation found in his body a tiny spherical pellet that probably had been fired from a compressed gas-operated gun inside the deadly umbrella. Holes in the pellet held the toxin ricin. This political murder underlined something that we've seen. The Cold War, while short of an all-out conflict, was not a bloodless period of stability. It exacted its victims. The global cost of the Cold War conflict and conflicts that were quite separate from the Cold War we'll examine in our next lecture.